Well, thank you, everyone. Again, we are recording this for the Fing high-tech group and some of the others. And tonight, a little just with it, the repeating part of what we had. Our topic tonight is implementing healthcare reform registration and call details you've been given. This will be approximately a one-hour teleconference. We'll go about 45 minutes or so, and then I'll unmute everyone for questions along the way. Our speaker comes from us, courtesy of the Los Angeles Fing chapter, who highly recommended Stephen Roy, the CEO of Benefit Management Advisors. Their website is www.benefitadvisors.biz. And Stephen was nice enough, he gave us a deck of the PowerPoint slides from that presentation in advance of this, which are available. They're hosted on my website at fiscaldoctor.com/fing-healthcare, fiscaldoctor.com/feng-healthcare. We've asked Stephen to give us a one-hour overview. He's going to talk about the major points of the legislation, the good, the bad, the ugly, to consider as you, our audience, are developing a business roadmap for the implementation of, you know, and being compliant with the new health law. So with that, joining us. Did I lose you?
No, I am here if you
perfect. Already, can you just start us with a broad overview of how PPACA has evolved so far? That'll, the abbreviation alone is scary.
Yeah. Well, PPACA is the Patient Protection and Accountable Care Act. I'm going to use ACA throughout the discussion, which is Affordable Care Act. The general overview of its history is it was enacted in 2010, then challenged legally for roughly 2 years based on provisions in the act that extended Medicare. Those provisions were overturned by the Supreme Court and required all individuals to acquire health insurance either through their employers or under their own account. Those provisions were upheld, specifically because the act imposes a penalty on anyone who is unable or unwilling to acquire coverage, and that penalty is within Congress's power to tax individuals. So that's the general background. The overview is that the PPACA affects insurers who have to provide products that meet certain regulatory requirements, and businesses who, depending on size, may either be required to provide coverage or may apply for and receive a tax credit for giving non-mandatory coverage. The part that has been in the news the most in the last 3 to 4 weeks has been the individual mandate, which requires individuals to obtain coverage if their employer doesn't provide it, and establishes a network of exchanges through which that coverage can be obtained. The federal exchanges have had a very rocky opening, he said, understating the case a great deal. Long story short, they opened before they should have and didn't function as they should have.
Well, that pain will spare everybody. What about the employer's obligation? I mean, because this is pretty much going to be a crowd, the technology-oriented, a little oriented toward the younger high-growth companies. But these CFOs, controllers, VP of finance, they have to make this stuff work. So
yes.
Dive in, if you would, on employer
the
obligation.
Employer obligation is to provide coverage if you are a company with in excess of 50 full-time equivalent employees. That coverage can be obtained through what is called a shop exchange, that is group coverage, and the exchange is oriented to employers. In the run-up to fixing the individual site, the shop exchanges were delayed by a year on the federal exchanges. So at the moment, we have a sort of bifurcated approach. The state of California and Massachusetts and the 16 other states that have rolled out their own websites, by and large, all offer group coverage to employers. So you can go to those exchanges and you can price and obtain coverage. In any state that is using a federal exchange in lieu of the state exchange, you won't be able to do that until a year from January. So the implementation of the law, as far as the employer mandate is concerned, has been delayed by about a year.
Now, is that going to delay this 2,000 or 3,000? I've heard differing numbers per employee. Are you saying that our audience gets a one-year reprieve on that with look back or such?
Yes, that is what I am saying. That reprieve, however, was granted a while back in October or thereabouts, when it became obvious that the exchanges were not going to be functioning at optimum levels. And quite frankly, because most employers weren't ready to go, and the IRS, the Health and Human Services, and DOL have been consistently late issuing regulations. So to a very large extent, nobody knew what those regulations were. The $2,000 penalty.
Oh, let me do one thing before we do it. Just before, I don't want to lose our audience who will say, we have a year, we don't have to worry about it. I want them to know a little snippet is you're looking at a big, big chunk of money that you better find a way to make up for it ahead of time. So before you give up too early, as I've talked to some clients who have, let's talk about what we've got and give you some orders of magnitude, because it is scary to me. Back to you again, our expert.
In relation to that, the average cost of an insurance policy for one employee without dependents and without spouse in the U.S. right now is nominally $5,000 a year. In addition to that, most employer plans take on additional expenses. So the average expense for the plan, not just the insurance, is on the order of $8,000 a year. That means that a company that does not currently offer coverage to its employees and passes over the 50-employee threshold is potentially on the hook for somewhere between $250,000 and $400,000. And as they progress toward 100 employees, that number doubles into the $500,000 to $800,000 per year range. If you are a startup company and using your cash for startup expenses, that's quite a hit, and it's quite a hit to your bottom line.
Let's just round it up. Good CFOs round up. So you tell me it's a minimum $500,000, but it's more likely this is $1 million a year issue that you're going to help us with tonight.
This is for a company with approximately 100 employees. This is a $1 million a year issue. The numbers I quoted are for single employee coverage without dependents and without spouses, and does not take into account any commitments that may have been made to retirees who are not included in that bottom line count.
Or regulatory and compliance costs? Is that,
yes.
Is that where the other $200,000 is going to be?
It's compliance costs. It's participation in deductibles and co-pays. It is the provision of ancillary services like wellness programs and on-site medical aid, all of which are subsumed. So that $8,000 a year figure is the total of the direct cost of insurance plus all of the point of delivery costs that the employers typically absorb. So, again, somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million, depending on the suite of benefits that is offered and the region that you live in. If you are in Alaska, you can add a roughly $3,000 to $4,000 per employee to that. If you are in Arkansas, you can subtract about $1,000 from it. But generally speaking, the cost of coverage is on the order of $5,000 a year, and the ancillary administrative costs and the like are on the order of $3,000 per employee per year. Now that compares dismally to the penalties that I believe Gary mentioned earlier are either $2,000 or $3,000 per eligible employee. The $2,000 penalty applies if you fail to provide coverage at all to eligible employees. The $3,000 penalty applies if you provide inadequate or unaffordable coverage to those employees. However, the basis for the penalty is different. In the one instance, it is $2,000 per eligible employee. In the second instance, it is $3,000 per employee who applies to and receives a subsidy through either a state or federal exchange. So, Gary, you have heard correctly. There are two penalties out there, but the basis for their application is different. And you pay whichever one is the highest if the inadequate or unaffordable penalty applies. That is, if the employees don't ever show up to claim their subsidies through the exchanges, you would be paying the $3,000 per head penalty, but on a much smaller employee base.
Boy, I can see. I mean, it looks like you're incenting, as I've talked to some people, this incents people just to dump everybody into that because, you know, 3,000 versus 2, this is a pretty numbers-oriented crew you've got here to look at it. But you've given us the magnitude of the two items, so you've given us sort of the triangle, the if-then statement, the biggest if-then statement to go through.
Now the penalties are fairly nominal until you begin to realize that they don't take into account all of the costs that happen when your competition is offering coverage and you are not. The penalty itself is non-deductible. So you are paying the penalty with pre-tax dollars. The cost of coverage, on the other hand, is deductible. So immediately, whack 40 to 50% off the top of that $8,000 price. But the real stickler here will be, what does it cost you to replace an employee who departs your company because they think you're cheap and you don't provide coverage? And the answer to that almost invariably is way more than you think it does. The Personnel Association estimates that to replace a highly skilled worker, a corporate officer or manager, or a highly successful salesperson costs somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 times that person's annual salary. So there is a sort of zone in which your cost indirectly as a result of failing to provide coverage can in fact swamp the cost differential between the coverage and the penalties. Now that zone is defined differently for every industry, depending on how sensitive your retention rates are to offering benefits.
We're starting to inch into a strategy to apply this, as we talked about, or one of the questions we had. Can you give us a couple strategies within this framework so we can start sort of putting the pieces in the right little stacks?
Okay. Typically, the job lock for companies that do or do not offer insurance, depending on industry, is somewhere between 3 and 13%. That means that at any given time, 3 to 13% of your workforce in a company is working for you for their benefits. If you change your benefit strategy, you will see that somewhere between 3 and 13% of your current employees go work for your competitors. That will not be true for companies that evolve into that range. So what you need to do strategically is look at roughly how many of your employees are going to leave, and then determine what it's going to cost to replace them. Now, in a company that pays anything in excess of about $80,000 a year per employee, you are almost invariably going to be better off paying for coverage. So the strategy that has been touted in the media and by some people as pay or play, or what we call the Nancy Reagan strategy, just say no, can be very, very costly if it affects your employee retention. In my book, there are two examples. The first one is companies that have a workforce that is highly specialized and highly paid. For them, it is almost inevitably the optimal choice to offer coverage. So low-skill, low-wage companies in arenas like the restaurant industry or farm labor where workforce is abundant, recruitment costs are minimal, and training costs are not excessive, it is almost inevitably the correct choice to deny coverage to your employees. The cost of coverage, net after-tax cost of coverage, is typically higher in those industries than it is in than is the penalty. So one of the six key strategies that we have identified is what we call the payer play or refusniki strategy. But one of the key takeaways, hopefully, from today's discussion is that before you adopt any of these strategies, make sure you have identified all of the potential costs and benefits from adapting the strategy. The primary unaccounted for cost in a naive approach to pay-don't-play is what does it cost to replace an employee and what does it do to your reputation as a company. You might find that some of the other strategies are far better than a simple, okay, I'm not going to pay. And like I said, we have identified six key strategies.
Well, if we've done two, I mean, I think most of our audience is pretty familiar with some kind of a cafeteria plan. It sounds like that's, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, you've given us the two extremes on the bell curve. Is there some version of the cafeteria plan in the middle somewhere for us?
Yes and no. The coverage is required to be non-discriminatory. So if you choose a don't play strategy, you have to choose it for all of your employees. One of the net effects of that is that your management employees are probably going to be a bit disgruntled. So approaching it not from the perspective of denying or granting coverage, there are a number of other ways to approach the issue. You can manage the size of the company.
Let me stop one second. Let me raise one thing that you and I touched on just briefly, and I don't know if you were able to find. Someone told me while I was getting ready for this in another group that right now, based on the government statement in, I think, one, I don't know if it was the Notre Dame suit or something else, that 70% of the existing health care plans that people have, which is what our audience out there has, on these things with it, are, quote, non-compliant and are going to have to be replaced, so that even some of us who think that, you know, this is interesting, I'll look at it, that the likelihood we're going to have to go through all this number crunching is probably higher than our audience thinks, because that 70% surprised me. Have you gotten a better number on what percentage of plans are going to be, quote, non-compliant based upon current definitions?
Based on current definitions, literally everything out there would be non-compliant, because literally every group plan out there has incorporated into it insurance company stop-loss provisions that are no longer permitted in group plans. So unless you have the ability to grandfather your old plan, you're going to have to replace it with a new coverage. Sometimes that transition will be very smooth, because the insurers themselves will simply rewrite the policy and drop the exclusions and the stop-loss limits. But I think 70% is probably a reasonable figure for that. That 70% of the plans are in fact non-compliant and will have to be replaced eventually.
So the three people on this call have got another problem they didn't know. Not only are they looking at 500,000 to 1,000,000, but two-thirds of them are going to have to go through changing these plans, even if they thought they didn't have a problem.
Well, roughly 65% of companies in the 50 and up category already provide coverage. 70% of those will no doubt have to change their policies, and literally 100% will change whether transparent or not. So, yes, they will have to respect their plans to take into account the fact that the new plans will cover more. The other inevitable issue there is that those plans will be more expensive because of that. When you cover a broader spectrum of services, the plan becomes more expensive. The only saving grace is that the risk pool has been altered significantly, and insurance companies will not have to guard as vigilantly against adverse selection as they have had in the past. So that influence will reduce somewhat the cost, but the expansion of services, there are almost 30 preventive services that must be covered 100% by any new policy. In addition to that, there are what are called essential services that must be covered to the extent of at least 60% of the potential morbidity on the condition. Those policies are going to be more expensive simply because the insurer is now assuming responsibility for the copay or deductible with respect to all of the preventive services, and the increased breadth of the coverage for all of the essential services. So,
but I was told that if I liked my policy, I wouldn't have to change it, and I got to keep all my doctors.
What can I say to you, Gary? You were lied to.
Well, you've given us some good frameworks on the things, because I think we've talked about, because again, some of the questions that our audience gave us, one of them was, when is it best, or is it ever best to just pay the penalty? I think we've talked about that one, but what about this, the other related question they gave? So, to give people a little more, some details to look at that one. How is it possible to adjust company size, labor hours, or coverage to minimize this? Because that's what we're reading in the press.
Mm-hmm. The answer is that yes, within limits you can do so. The mandate applies only to companies who have 50 or more full-time equivalent employees. So if you are a mature company that sees no reason to grow and you're under that 50 mark, you can stay there. That's not one that's likely to appeal in a really dynamic growth environment like what we've been talking about. I refer to it as the slow, no, or negative growth option. And from a pizzazz point of view, it is exactly what the acronym spells out. It's snoring. It's a boring way to do business.
What is it? Is it northern or southern Italy? I can't remember which. It's the situation they're in.
It's pretty much all of Italy, but it is the northern part of Italy in particular has seen little or no growth in business activity. Most entrepreneurs aren't going to be satisfied with that solution. So they have to find other ways. And one of the ways that I think will become very, very popular is outsourcing. If you are a tech company, outsourcing your coding and activities of that sort has probably already occurred to you simply because the labor rates in Hyderabad are considerably cheaper than the labor rates over here. But that also sheds employee count, keeping that growing tech company under that 50 full-time equivalent number. Another way to approach it while still growing is to grow using primarily part-time workers. The coverage requirement applies to only employees who work 30 or more hours a week. So if you have a task that can be compartmentalized and is highly divisible, meaning you can assign it to a number of different people to get it done, there's an opportunity to use part-time labor to minimize the number of people that are covered or who are eligible for coverage. Now, there are some cautions associated with that. If you are already a company with a full-time workforce, switching them all to part-time will probably get you sued. The trial bar is just grinning in anticipation because the provisions of ACA create a very realistic scenario for litigation. And ERISA, Section 510, is probably a slam dunk in that scenario. ERISA 510 basically says that it is illegal to discriminate in the provision of any benefit if that discrimination affects eligibility for the benefit. Well, I'm cutting you from 40 hours to 29 hours, certainly affects your eligibility and probably comes well within the ERISA statute, if not within the scope of... So you don't really want to do radical realignments of the workforce, but as your full-time people attrit out, each time one does, you want to consider whether or not a 40-hour-a-week worker can be replaced with two 20s.
Well, let's do this, Steve, because I think the thing is we've said, you know, again, most of our audience is going to be in the tech area. You know, they may, you know, the issue of that, there's not as many in the light manufacturing, restaurants, or some of the other areas. So if we've got, what the gist of this, even to my slow brain, says you're going to be stuck with this, find a whole lot of extra money. What can we do to cost contain it? You've given us a $500,000 to $1 million this year. What can we do so that this number doesn't get bigger, or so we do it? There's got to be something to stop the rising cost that you would suggest.
Okay. There are a couple of approaches to it. Cost controls are one means of doing it. The polite euphemism is increasing employee responsibility. What that means is shifting expenses from the employer to the employee by means of higher deductibles, higher copay policies, or diminished participation in those by the employer. A number of companies have approached it from that. One of the more novel ways that it has been approached is actually to use the individual exchanges to obtain coverage for employees at more or less discounted rates. Seeing the evolution right now of a lot of private exchange activity, essentially group endeavors to increase the risk pool, the numbers of people in the risk pool, and the diversity of that risk pool in order to bring down overall costs. Those are two very obvious ways. One of the other ways that companies have approached it is to reduce the population of covered people. Sort of the ultimate means of doing that is to eliminate spousal coverage. Under ACA, dependents are sacrosanct. You can't really shed them very easily. But spouses have no such protections. In fact, they didn't have those protections under old law, much less under ACA. So you see companies like UPS who have adopted a strategy where if your spouse qualifies for coverage where they work, UPS will not cover that spouse under their own policy. Now, UPS is a really prime example because they have really, really good coverage. They shed over 15,000 covered lives by adopting that policy, simply because since their policy was better than a lot of other policies, they had a lot of spouses who were employed elsewhere and could obtain coverage elsewhere who had elected into UPS's policy. Now, even if you are not paying for the spousal coverage, if it is the employee's responsibility, you save money through that tactic because there are administrative costs involved, and once again, because it alters the characteristics of the risk pool. You no longer have unaccountable workers within your group's risk pool. So one of the primary candidates for that kind of approach is actually retirees. If you have retirees in your group plan, you are probably paying somewhere between 20 and 30% more than you need to pay. The retirees alter the risk structure, effectively creating a skewed elder population within your plan. If they are on your plan, you're paying too much. The solution is offer them the opportunity through a private exchange and a separate program to purchase their own policy with a subsidy from you. That strategy works in a number of different contexts because it essentially fixes your obligation to that retiree or to that employee or spouse. So you have both current control over your risk pool and long-term control over the growth of your exposures.
Let's do this, Steve, because I'm looking at the time. We're at 6:40, and I want to, in about another 5 minutes, open this up, stop the recording, let people ask. The standard thing at this point in time, the next one, you know, again, and we're going to ask you to give us a phone number and how to find you. For someone's questions, what are the three best things you are telling your clients right now? You know, A, B, and C. What would that be?
I am telling my clients the following three takeaways. The first one is healthcare reform is here. It is going to stay. You can't stick your head in the sand. You have to plan now because it's a potentially very expensive arena. It is going to stay simply because the United States, as a nation, pays almost four times the percentage of gross household income for health care as any other industrialized nation. And for that four times as much, we are typically somewhere in the middle of the pack as far as quality measures go. We rank very high in research and education, and we're very mediocre on any kind of performance measures. So reform is coming. To some extent, PPACA is just the beginning. PPACA didn't even address things like mental health parity. It didn't address tort reform. So more is on the way. That's the first point. The second point is, before you adopt any strategy, look at what the costs and benefits are. What is it going to cost in unintended consequences for the choice that you've made?
You are probably even more positive than our CFO and controller buddies. They must love
I'm
you.
I'm sorry?
I said you are even more optimistic than the CFOs and controllers on this call. I can't wait for the third one.
Okay. And the third one we actually never got to talk about here is the third element is go proactive. Offer additional benefits like welfare programs and employee assistance programs and on-site clinics and private exchanges. And the reason for that is that though they may cost money, they have extremely high ROIs in terms of affecting your productivity. If you have an on-site clinic, for example, nobody has to go off-site to get their cold treated. You don't lose a work day. The typical ROI on these typical payback over a long period of time is somewhere between $2.40 and $3 for every invested dollar. So they are extraordinarily effective means. And don't involve telling employees they can't have something. So they're a wonderful morale and corporate culture booster, and they pay for themselves. So that's my three takeaways.
Perfect. Well, let's do this. I mean, tell us how the audience or the people who are going to listen to the recording later can reach you. And if you'll do that, briefly after that, I'm going to stop the recording and we'll turn it open for questions.
Okay. You all can reach me at 818-489-4228. That is my cell phone, and it's with me 24/7. The other way to reach me is by email at stephen.roy@ccsrinc. That's ccsrinc.com. Now, if you leave off the INC, you'll be sending messages to Brother Stephen at the Christian Community of San Rafael. He may very well be able to tell you how to make wine, but he won't be able to tell you how to enact miracles in your health plan. Now, if anyone would like to send me an email, I will return a copy of version 4 of my book, Implementing PPACA free. That fourth edition will be ready in about 20 days. It'll be ready a little after Christmas. So if you would like to send me an email and request it, I will put you on a list to send out copies to.
Okay.
All right, Gary?
That sounds good. And again, we're leaving up the first site, so your slides from the first presentation are there. This will be the updated version. And what I'm going to do is, in just a moment, I'm going to stop the recording and take a slide again.
Okay.